Welcome to the 435th meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations. To those here today and to our radio audience listening on the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from the Elks Event Center in Rockland, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. Since 1983, the Forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert talk about issues critical to the formulation of U.S. foreign policy and to answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. These forum meetings provide citizens with the opportunity to learn about and discuss the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies and factors influencing them. Details about and audios of past forum talks, upcoming forum programs, and information on how to become a forum member are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are very pleased to have Sujah Nawaz with us to speak on Pakistan and South Asia. Sujah Nawaz is a distinguished fellow of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. He was the first director of the South Asia Center, serving in that capacity from 2009 to 2014. Mr. Nawaz is a political and strategic analyst who appears frequently in leading print, broadcast, and online news outlets, and who has worked on projects with RAND, the United States Institute of Peace, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Atlantic Council, and other leading think tanks on projects dealing with Pakistan and the Middle East. Mr. Nawaz spent 30 years working at the International Monetary Fund, where he headed three separate divisions. While on leave from the International Monetary Fund, he served as a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency from 1999 to 2001. My goodness, we have a phone going off. Mr. Nawaz was the managing editor and then editor of Finance and Development, the multilingual quarterly of the IMF and World Bank, and he also served on the editorial advisory board of the World Bank Research Observer. Mr. Nawaz's latest book, The Battle for Pakistan, The Bitter U.S. Friendship and a Tough Neighborhood, was published abroad last spring and will be released here in the United States in May. He is the author of a number of other books on Pakistan and South Asia. Sujah, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you, George. Thank you very much, George, and thank you to all of you for coming here. I know that there's probably much more experience and knowledge on some of the topics that I'm going to address in my audience than resides in my tiny brain. And I'll keep that in mind as I make my remarks with a certain degree of humility and modesty, hoping that you will further enrich my knowledge as we go into the, especially into the question and answers section. Just to clarify, we had to wait for a US edition to come out because Penguin Random House, when they got the proposal, were so excited to publish the book out of their headquarters in India as a South Asia edition that they said they would bring it out in 8 months' time. And so by the end of August, they had the edition ready, which meant that we weren't quite ready yet with the US edition. But I'm glad to know that Roman and Littlefield got on the ball, and we have the US edition. This is the cover of the US edition. For those of you that can see it, it has a very familiar menacing image of a predator drone, which probably had its most effective and frequent use in the borderlands of Pakistan during the Afghan war that has not yet ended. Also a clarification, of course, the hardback copy that Roman and Littlefield is publishing is designed for libraries, so it's really not designed for individuals. They will have a paperback released simultaneously, which will be for people like me that can afford to buy it. Yes, you can get the hardback today at a slightly lower price. So if you would like, I'd be happy to sign the copies afterwards and personalize them. Let me start by saying that I think it was Mark Twain who said that history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. And I think this has been the case with Afghanistan and the region, and it has been the case with the relationship of the United States to the region. We seem to go in a kind of roller coaster, and we also seem to go in circles. And so I thought it would be interesting, instead of trying to compress the 400 pages plus of my book into 20 minutes or half an hour of my initial talk and then having the Q&A after that, if I picked up certain themes and gave you some of the background to the events that we should all be aware of. Now, I do this again knowing that many of you may have been part of those events if you were in government service, particularly, or working on the Hill in the last couple of decades. If not, I'm sure that you followed them through the news and are well informed. So let me see if I can go a little behind the scenes based on the work that I did in producing this book. This book emerged after I had spent almost a decade at the Atlantic Council working on the region and working with other think tanks on the region. And in that process, I had worked with people in the region as well as in the United States. And in the administration, in the Department of Defense, particularly the Department of State, and with people on the Hill. And so I had a lot of direct first-hand knowledge and notes that I kept. Having been a journalist in an earlier life, I was very assiduous in taking notes. But then when I decided that there was time to write a book, I went back to most of the key people that I interacted with during this period, in the region as well as in Washington, and I said, would you sit down for formal interviews with me, and on the record, preferably. And almost to a person, they agreed to sit down, and it was almost to a person on the record, which was really gratifying for an author to have that kind of a response. It was overwhelming, and I tried to make sense of the information that they gave me by triangulating it so that the same issue is covered by two or three different people, and I'm trying to buy into their different perspectives. And that's what I'm sharing with you in the book. And that's what I'm going to talk about in some of the episodes that I think are important. Now, I'm speaking in the backdrop of an event that took place at Doha, which was the signing of a deal between the United States and Taliban. And for those of you that read whatever was shared of the text of that agreement, it was a very curious, paradoxical agreement. It talks about the United States signing this agreement with the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, whom the United States does not recognize as an entity. And this is repeated about six times, which means that we are giving them legitimacy by doing that. So the moment you say Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, that's it. But the fact that we had to repeat it six times was to convince ourselves that we were not recognizing them as an entity. So it's a very curious verbiage. And the way it was handled also is very curious, because as we are now discovering that there were secret annexes to this agreement, which are known to the Taliban, and they're the enemy, but are not known to the general public in the United States, who are not the enemy. They were shared with people on the Hill, but they're not allowed to disseminate that information. So it's a very strange happening. But this agreement may or may not work the way we wanted it to. But it will certainly allow the president, who made a campaign promise that he would exit the war in Afghanistan, to check this off his list before the next election. He's been very good at identifying different topics on which he said he would do certain things, and he did them. So he pulled out of the Paris Accord, pulled out of TPP, you know, a lot of things that he had in his list in the campaign, he has fulfilled. And this was one of the unfilled actions, and so it offers him that opportunity. But it may or may not solve the problem in Afghanistan, and that's really why I feel that we should take a look at the history. And this began in the early days of the Obama administration, when the president invited Bruce Rydell, who was a CIA analyst and a renowned scholar on the region, to come in and do a review of Afghanistan. Now, this was not the only review that was being done at that time. There had been one done by General Douglas Lute, Lieutenant General Douglas Lute, who had been in the Bush White House at the NSC. And that was supposed to be a kind of handing over document, as it were, for President Bush to President Obama. And General Lute also produced a PowerPoint deck, which was called 10 Wars, which basically pointed out the fact that we had somehow lost the focus on what we were doing in Afghanistan, that we were fighting 10 different wars within the country in the period since the invasion. Interestingly, when Stan McChrystal arrived in Afghanistan, he was the 10th commander that we had since the war began in October 2001. And he also confirmed to me that there were 10 different wars that were being fought. And even before that, Jim Jones, when he was the SACER, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, and he went to Afghanistan, the first thing he noticed was that there were at least 4 or 5 different wars that were being fought or not fought by the coalition, because the Germans had their own restrictions or constraints on what they could do. The Italians did their own thing, the Brits did their own thing, and the United States had its own purpose. And so he tried to make some sense of it. But by the time President Obama came into office, we still had this confusion about what is going on. And that confusion persisted. Unfortunately, by the time I finished the book, and I have a table there in which I talk about one war, 18, the book says 17 years, 18 commanders, and I've updated it in the American edition. So it's 18 years, 18 commanders. On average, we were changing our commanders every 13 months. And as you know, that's no way to fight a war, because each commander would bring his own team, and each commander had his own 100-day plan, and each commander looked over his shoulder and said that the previous guys really didn't get it right, and now we'll do it right. And every commander after almost every 6 months would say, we are turning the corner. And we turned so many corners that I think we did many circles in our Afghanistan war effort. And that only strengthened the Taliban, and it confused our allies. And so it really made it very difficult for anyone to win the war, whatever victory meant, because we never defined it. And we kept changing the goalposts. So when President Obama came in and Bruce Rydell was working on the review, I sent him a copy of the November 13, 1986 Soviet Politburo meeting minutes. And I highlighted electronically different segments of that. And it was fascinating to see how things had changed without being changed, without being different. The names were changed, obviously, but the purpose of the meeting of the Soviet Politburo was exactly the purpose of what President Obama was trying to do, which was to find a way of exiting this war and to define the end of the Afghanistan war. And so let me just give you a little background about that particular, I'm going back to 1986 now, because with that knowledge of history, we can now better appreciate what's happening today. Gorbachev had asked Shevardnadze and Andrei Gromyko to put together a note for this meeting. And this was a background note which had input from Marshal Akromiev, who was the Deputy Minister of Defense. And he said, try and clarify what are we doing in Afghanistan and what do we need to do? And how do we get out? And so there was a really robust discussion. And I went through the actual minute. It's in Russian as well as an English translation. And what Gorbachev says is, we've been fighting in Afghanistan for 6 years. And this is how he opened the meeting. He said, if the approach is not changed, we will continue to fight for another 20 to 30 years. This is very similar to what President Trump said when he said we should deal, you know, make a deal with the Taliban. We're going to be fighting the same war for a long time. And then Gromyko interjects and he says, in one word, it is necessary to pursue a political settlement. Our people will breathe a deep sigh if we undertake steps in that direction. Our strategic goal is to make Afghanistan neutral. They didn't want to lose it to the other side, to the Americans. And Akromiev, the military man, says, there is no single piece of land in this country which has not been occupied by a Soviet soldier. Nevertheless, the majority of the territory remains in the hands of the rebels. The whole problem is the fact that military results are not followed up by political actions. We have lost the battle for the Afghan people. We need to look for a way out. We must go to Pakistan. It all sounds very familiar because we have heard these words repeated by others and we have not learned our lessons. And so as a result of this very robust discussion, the Soviet Politburo decided that they would leave Afghanistan 2 years later in the event that was slightly delayed. So it was in the third year in 89 that they actually left. But they did not announce their date of departure. And they went to the neighboring countries. They went to China, Pakistan, Iran, and they went and got people in Geneva and they got everyone to agree on how this would be handled. And so that when Marshal Boris Gromov led his forces across the Friendship Bridge at Termez, nobody was firing at him and nobody was trying to kill him and his troops. It was a very peaceful move out of Afghanistan. They were done. And what did the US do? We decided we were done too, and we pulled out. And as a result, we had to go back in to complete the job. And in my interview with Brent Scowcroft, with whom I worked very closely at the Atlantic Council in my years there, he had earlier said this to me for my earlier book, Cross Swords, that we had to go into Afghanistan because we left a job unfinished. So that is really the story of our relationship with this conflict. And the story of our relationship with Pakistan, and I write about that in order to explain how we can better manage our foreign relations for that whole region, because I'm originally from Pakistan. I began writing this book when I was still a Pakistani. And I finished it when I had become an American citizen and I had sworn an oath to protect this country. Just for those of you that may not be aware of it, there are some that are aware, but I come from a military family which for centuries has done nothing but serve in the military. And I'm the first male in my line going back hundreds of years who has not joined the military. And that's because my elder brother, who was a young major then, persuaded me not to apply to the military academy and to continue to read and write because I liked doing that. He ended up becoming the army chief in Pakistan in 91 to 93 and died in office. But his advice didn't take me away from the military. I served as a war correspondent for PTV covering the 1971 India-Pakistan war on the Western Front and continued my interest, which is why I have been writing these books and studies. So this was one necessary part of the history that I think we need to remember as we look at the current agreement and try and see if we can make it work. The other part of the agreement was fascinating, which I discovered partly by accident. I was quite close to Jim Mattis when he was CENTCOM commander, and so we would meet every now and then. And he came once to my office after he'd been testifying on the Hill, and we talked about the region and Iran and other issues. And he said to me that he had a plan to capture or kill bin Laden in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And he told me the story. And then he said, but I know that you will not publish this because you're a friend. And I said, I will publish it, but I will publish it with your permission. And so that was then. And when he left the Department of Defense, when he left CENTCOM, he moved to Stanford. I called him up and I said, can we do an interview for my book on the record? And he agreed. And during the interview, I said, Jim, let me tell you a story. And I repeated the story he had told me about bin Laden. And because I'd gone back and immediately recorded it for my own notes. And he said to me, you have a good memory. And I said, yes, I made sure I took the details down. And I said, now may I have your permission to use this story? And he said, yes. I'm glad we had that conversation and we have it taped and there's a transcript, because soon after that he became Secretary of Defense and then he couldn't say anything to me. And so the story emerges right in the days after 9/11, and many of you will remember we had six CIA teams that were sent in with special forces guys in attendance into Afghanistan. And they were Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, and Echo. And Alpha was in the north, and then they went south, and Echo was the one that was around the Kandahar area. And there was no military support as such for this effort. And so it was decided to send a young brigadier general who had proven himself in the invasion of Kuwait in Desert Storm, and then had become a brigadier general in Iraq. And his name was James Mattis. And a lot of people don't know this, but he was designated to be the first Marine to command a naval expeditionary force. Mm. And it was called Task Force 58. And TF-58 was supposed to go and establish a base in southern or southwestern Afghanistan in order to have the military heft to get rid of the Taliban government, because the CIA teams were going to disrupt the whole system and then these people would move in and provide the military heft. And so Jim Mattis, first of all, asked CENTCOM if he could use the call sign Chaos, which was descriptive of the way that he operated, which was he'd disrupt a lot of things of the status quo. But in his words, also stood for Colonel has an outstanding suggestion. And so he arrived in Pakistan And he knew exactly where the power lay. He went straight to the military. He went to the Joint Chiefs of Staff headquarters. And he made a personal relationship with the Major General, who was Director General Operations at the JCS headquarters, a general named Farooq Ahmad Khan. And in the process, he reached an agreement with him. And under the agreement, he said, look, we are Marines, we come by sea. So we're going to come by sea and land in Pakistan, and then you're going to help me get to Afghanistan. And so, sure enough, they found a port slightly to the west of Karachi, which is the main port of Pakistan, called Pasni, which is also an airfield and also a point of reference for air flights going into Afghanistan for the invasion. And then I called the corps commander at that time in Karachi, and turns out he was a classmate of mine from nursery school in Pakistan. And I asked him for details about what happened, and he said, yes, I got a call from Joint Chiefs headquarters, and I sent six Punjab regiment, or one of the Punjab regiments, to cordon the whole city so nobody could go in or out. And the Marines would land at night. We would take them to Pasni airfield, keep them under wraps during the day, and the next evening we'd bus them inland to Jacobabad, where there was a base, an air base, which was given to the United States for use as a jumping off point. And as Jim Mattis told me, they found a spot which he called Objective Rhino, which later became FOB Rhino, for Forward Operating Base Rhino, and then became Camp Rhino, one of the largest camps that we had in Afghanistan and probably still do. Interesting side note to this, that Ambassador Rick Olson, who was the ambassador in Pakistan, had been ambassador in the UAE. And he explained to me that when he went to deliver a note to the Crown Prince of the UAE, this was the famous "Are you with us or against us?" note that went to Pakistan and a few other countries in the region. The Crown Prince agreed to being with the US, but he also said, by the way, I own an airfield that I've been using for hunting Hubara bustards in southwest Afghanistan. And if it's something that you guys can use, maybe you can use it. And so he handed over that airfield to the United States. And that was really where Camp Rhino came into being. So a little bit of previous relationships and history that helps us understand that you had the military and the CIA trying to work together, but it didn't work out because Jim Mattis had looked at Tora Bora, where bin Laden was hiding, and he went back to his history study and the operation that captured Geronimo, and he had his people do a computer map to show where the heights were around Tora Bora, where the cave where bin Laden was hiding existed, and that if he could capture those heights, then nobody could go in or out. And he would either kill or capture bin Laden. And he made this point to his superior, whom he refused to identify, but others have identified as General Tommy Franks, the head of CENTCOM. And Franks said, no, the CIA has it under control. And the CIA actually had been asking for military help, but they hadn't been getting it. So there was just complete confusion at that end, and in the event, bin Laden escaped. And the rest, as you know, is history till 2011, when he was eventually killed or captured. So in sum, what these events show is that we are unable to marshal all the facts and information of history when we need to. And in our relationship with Pakistan, it's been an up and down one where they have assisted in some cases and then held back on others. And they've been hedging their bets, and they continue to hedge their bets. And you will see in the next few months how they handle the Taliban, and how when the Taliban break parts of the agreement that they've signed with the Americans, the Pakistanis are likely to be mum. Because what they don't want is a possibility which is a nightmare scenario for them, which is the Taliban taking over Kabul. Because if they take over Kabul, then they're going to support Islamic militancy inside Pakistan and will want an Islamic emirate to emerge in Pakistan. And there's ample evidence already that the Pakistani military has been infiltrated by elements that are leaning in that direction. And this is what scares the commanders in the Pakistan military and should scare us too, because we're not talking of an ordinary country. We're not talking of Paraguay, we're talking of Pakistan. It's a nuclear armed country. It has a regular army which is slightly larger than the regular army of the United States. And it's in a strategic location bordering India, Iran, China. And unless and until we have a policy that is based on Pakistan and how to deal with it, and not as a subset of our policy in Afghanistan, we will continue to make the same mistakes that have characterized our relationship with the region for the last 3 or 4 decades. I tried to compress all of this with a little detail. I'm going to stop here because I know your questions are going to unfold a lot of the other bits and pieces that I hope to share with you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for your insights into the politics of this area. While people are collecting questions from the audience, I always take the advantage of being up here to ask the first question. You talk about the role of the U.S. in Afghanistan, but I wanted to know if you could comment a little more on what the role of Pakistan and other neighbors of Afghanistan have in creating a stable situation in Afghanistan. I mean, we all ultimately want that to be a stable region of the world. And do the neighbors of Afghanistan have a role in that? If so, what?
You're quite right. They do have a role, but they have not contributed to creating stability in Afghanistan. And the reason for that is that they have approached Afghanistan through a very narrow prism. So Pakistan, for instance, has approached Afghanistan, which is a congeries of various sects, so Shia and Sunni and various tribes that are divided by their geography within Afghanistan, and that over the years have created an internal balance based on what they call Misak-e-Milli, which is a concord of the people, where they learn to live with each other and have a relatively weak center that acts as a political glue. This used to be the Shah, Zahir Shah, the king of Afghanistan. But when the United States moved in and we installed Hamid Karzai, we wanted to create a strong center. And that turned out to be the internal weakness of Afghanistan. So Karzai and his people sitting in the palace in Kabul were even approving appointments of headmasters of schools in the provinces. And this exacerbated the tensions within Afghanistan. And Pakistan, as an example, looked at Afghanistan through a Pakhtun prism. Now, I say Pakhtun because in the north, that's the way it is said, but in the west, the generally accepted word is Pashtun, but it's the same word. It just means people from that part of the world. And they are the majority in Afghanistan, but more Pakhtun live in Pakistan than in Afghanistan. And the largest Pakhtun city in the world today is Karachi. It has something like 5 million Pakhtun. And so that was their narrow perspective. And they ignored the western part of Afghanistan. They ignored the northern part of Afghanistan. Iran only focused on its wedge, which was, you know, bordering it, because it had refugees and it also had economic relationships. And then India wanted to see Afghanistan as some kind of a strategic sandwich that it could squeeze Pakistan from both sides by supporting dissident groups and insurgents that were fighting the Pakistani military along the border and particularly in Balochistan. So as a result, the neighbors have contributed to the problems of Afghanistan rather than contributing to the stability. They pay lip service, but we haven't really made it worthwhile. And the one thing that has been missing from this agreement in Doha is a commitment on the part of the United States to the economic development of Afghanistan, and particularly that border region with Pakistan, where the biggest problems lie.
Thank you. It's always nice to have your neighbors more of the problem than the solution. Why is the U.S.-Pakistan relationship a bitter one, as you titled your book?
Well, that's the paradox. It's been very good over the years, but when the United States is looking at it as a transactional relationship, it becomes very bad. And let me illustrate. The United States has been responsible for building up Pakistan's agriculture through the Green Revolution. It built up Pakistan's ability to manage its economy by helping create the Planning Commission of Pakistan, which produced the best economists in the world. Many of them ended up very senior positions at the World Bank and the IMF. It built up the educational system inside the country through the Presbyterian Church. So Gordon College, where I went to school, or the Foreman Christian College in Lahore, where among others, the former president of Pakistan, General Musharraf, went, are all created by U.S. Help. The Lahore University of Management Sciences, the nuclear reactor at Nilor near Islamabad, where they learned how to manage nuclear power and then eventually ended up going to the nuclear weapons route, was given by the United States. The biggest dams in Pakistan, which have been keeping the country going and providing electricity and water, were built with U.S. assistance, so at Mangla and Tarbela. And they stand as evidence of the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. The earthquake relief in 2005 that the U.S. provided, where our Chinook helicopters were called angels of mercy, this was, or the flood relief in 2010, where the U.S. immediately went in. Incidentally, the same person that helped with the earthquake relief, Admiral Mike Lefevre, was there, and he helped with the flood relief too. So this is the good part. And the bad part is that because the U.S. made Pakistan dependent on its military assistance, it could cut it off too, and it did. And it put sanctions on Pakistan for its nuclear development at the same time as it sanctioned India, but it was an unequal relationship because India was way ahead in terms of economic power. Pakistan didn't have the military might nor the economy to sustain the sanctions. And so within the country, there is a narrative of victimhood which they use to speak against the United States and to make people think that the U.S. is not a friend but an enemy. So the term frenemy has come into use. Mm-hmm. That's what describes the relationship.
Thank you. There's several questions here on whether or not when the U.S. finally leaves Afghanistan, the Taliban will take over. Let me read a couple of them to you and ask you to comment. If you look ahead 10 to 15 years, could the Taliban be a workable ally, or at least an adversary with which we can deal rationally? Or is there any chance that the Taliban will not be in control of Afghanistan in 10 years?
You know, at the Atlantic Council, we did a lot of work with the National Intelligence Council. And one of the things I learned with those exercises with the NIC was that you don't try and predict things, but you produce scenarios so that under certain sets of circumstances, something will happen or something may not happen. And then there are black swan events. So the coronavirus is a black swan event. Nobody knew this was coming. And there are many other black swan events. the secular shift in the monsoon as a black swan event that nobody has control over. So I'm going to rely on scenarios. And the first, I'm a born optimist, I remain an optimist, even though my friend Arno de Boograf told me that a pessimist is an optimist with experience. So my optimistic scenario is this, that the Pakistani military and the Pakistani civil government will, for their own selfish reasons, decide that there must be a monopoly of state power in the country, and it must only reside with the state, and there should be no militant groups allowed to function inside Pakistani territory. If you eliminate those militant groups, you eliminate the base that will give sustenance to the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And that will give sustenance to violence in India or Kashmir or whatever. But we don't know what will happen, and this is just unfolding. The extreme right-wing shift within India to have a Hindu-dominated society against a Muslim population that matches the population of Pakistan, who are in many cases threatened with disenfranchisement, is likely to strengthen the hands of the extreme right-wing Islamists within Pakistan. And so we don't know where that will go. And all this affects what Pakistan does or doesn't do with Afghanistan. I think if both India and Pakistan look to Afghanistan as a place where they can invest, and India has already invested over $3 billion, Pakistan about $300 million, particularly in northern Afghanistan, which has been traditionally an area that Pakistan has ignored, then you might be able to stabilize the Afghanistan situation, or the Afghans will be able to stabilize the Afghan situation. On the reverse side is the ability of the military and the intelligence services to convince themselves that they know exactly which buttons to press and what results will emerge. And their record has not been good, but that doesn't stop them from trying the same thing again and again. And they will try and buy support and produce some leaders, and some of them are in the photograph with President Ghani. One of them particularly is a man named Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who had fought in the Soviet jihad against the occupiers with US help, but who was a favorite of the Pakistan intelligence services. And it was reputed that he had killed more Afghans than the Soviets did, because he would ambush and take the supplies. So I think by keeping their hands off Afghanistan, Pakistan can help create a much more integrated Afghan polity than trying to find a Taliban rule sitting or rulers sitting in Kabul.
Thank you. Here's one about more about the U.S. than about the situation there, but is our experience in Afghanistan an anomaly, or is our capacity to protect, project force effectively now broken? Is the U.S. the same power it once used to be?
I think the U.S. has the power. It can do a lot. I think it needs to be much more modest in what it can do when it goes, particularly relying on military power around the world. The other thing, and I say this in my book, you can't fight ideologies with military. You have to change the landscape, and the landscape has to be changed internally within the region by the people of the region. You can only be a catalyst. And you can be a catalyst if you can find a way to relate to people rather than with the ruling entities. Unfortunately, because of our interest in being imprisoned by the calendar of domestic election cycles, every 2 years we have Congress, every 4 years the presidential election, we tend to go for the short run wins. And that means, in some cases, making bad deals with bad people in countries with whom we need much better relationships. So we lose the people, and we gain the trust and friendship, quote unquote, of those groups. And so as a result, you have people like Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, who, you know, there was an election, there was a way of removing the previous president through elections, but the military moved in, and we are happy with that arrangement. In my book, I talk of the danger of, potential danger of creating an Egypt on the Indus in Pakistan. And so we have, if we avoid those mistakes, if we try to have a relationship with the people, there is much more love and respect of the United States. And I talk about the shining city on the hill, which the US should be and has been, and which is what attracts people from around the world to come here and make it a better place. That's the place where we want to be, and not a friend of despots and bigots and dictators.
Well, let's follow up on that a little bit. If Pakistan's government is not, you know, a good ally of the U.S. always, and the people of Pakistan are, how should the U.S. engage with Pakistan and with the people of Pakistan in order to be productive?
I think we already have the mechanisms. Pakistan today is the largest recipient of Fulbright scholarships in the world. So you have scholars from Pakistan coming in enormous numbers here. You had over 200 military officers a year coming under the IMET program, the International Military Education and Training Program, a DoD budget which the State Department manages, and we just shut it down. So we're going to lose a relationship with these younger officers who come in and who get to know us, and we get to know them, and then they go back and they become senior officers, because only the best and the brightest are sent to the United States for training. It's number one on the priority list of anyone in the Pakistan military. And somehow we have this knee-jerk reaction. We just shut it off. And it's only a $5 million program. Peanuts when you look at the big order of things. So we have to be much smarter in this. I think we have to maintain these relationships and find ways of bypassing the corrupt governments and the self-serving military leadership in countries like Pakistan, so that they can find support in Pakistan. There's a Pew survey has a question to which, you know, something like 53 to 60% of Pakistanis have answered, and they all say they want better relations with the United States. We have never unpacked that answer. We always keep highlighting the fact that they think the US is a big threat to Pakistan. That's because they feel that the US wants to take their nuclear weapons away.
Then there are some questions here related to other neighbors of Pakistan and Afghanistan. One is, does Iran have an active interest in Afghanistan and Pakistan?
Afghanistan has a very active interest in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, because there's a Balochistan province in Iran, and there's a Balochistan province in Pakistan. And traditionally, in the days of the Shah, there was an independent Balochistan government that was given refuge in Baghdad, and it was supported from there. And so there's been an insurgency inside Iran, and more recently a group called Jundullah, which has been supported allegedly by the CIA, operating out of Karachi and with the knowledge of Pakistan, has been operating against Iran. So Iran and Pakistan are neighbors, but they have this rather strange relationship because they're concerned about what the other is doing. Iran has a much more powerful interest in Afghanistan because of the language and the fact that they are Shia, in the part that abuts Iran and their economy, their teachers, and the entire fuel supply comes from Iran. Moreover, a very large proportion of Afghan refugees have been given shelter in Iran. They even went to the extent of the Taliban are a Sunni group, not a Shia group. They even gave the Taliban shelter after 9/11. So they have an interest, and they can play a role, which they did after 9/11, but we've cut them off now, so they're not participating.
Then the other country, of course, that's coming up here in a number of these questions is India. Let me read one of them and that kind of represents a class of them, and then I'll ask another one, which is another aspect of it. One is, can we have a positive relationship with Pakistan while still having a strong relationship with India?
Yes, that's the short answer. But I'm sure you are not going to be satisfied with that. So I'll give you a little longer answer. When I was running the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council, we had a slogan, which was our motto, which was called Waging Peace. And the key element in that was to have a dialogue on different issues between India and Pakistan. Because without that dialogue, there would be a caricature of each other existing in the minds of people. And so we had the very first military-to-military dialogue in a track two basis, so non-official. We also had a trade and business dialogue, and we had a water dialogue. All three areas which were of interest to both sides. Now, the US has, I think, effectively de-hyphenated India and Pakistan. So previously, Pakistan was a friend and India was in the Soviet camp. Or so the US believed, because it was non-aligned. So they relied on a lot of the Soviet Union for their weaponry, and they still do on Russia. Their Air Force is predominantly Russian-based. But having this friendship with Afghanistan, with Pakistan, and with India offers the US a great opportunity to do something that I favor, which is the recreation of what I call a new Grand Trunk Road initiative that would link Kabul to Dhaka through Pakistan and India. And this would make that part of the world, which is the least economically interconnected in the world, but which has traditionally been the most interconnected in the world. It was all part of the same empire. They had language and culture and trade and movement of peoples from one part of that region to the other. It would be a much bigger market and a balancer against the growth of China. And I would go so far as to say that if all this happens, if this scenario holds, this would be the center of gravity of global economic development, because you have almost 1.5 billion people, the population. You'd have a population larger than China. You have over 300 million middle-income people in India, 53 million middle-income people in Pakistan, average per capita income of $10,000 a year on a purchasing power parity basis. They will buy American goods and services, and we can be the market for their manufactured goods and also a home for many of our service industries, which India has already proven is possible and Pakistan is now proving. So yes, I think India and Pakistan could work together if they could only shed this mistrust that one of them is about to invade the other. And the US can play a role in that. It just needs to lean forward a bit without jumping back every time the Indians say boo.
And then there's another aspect of that. There's a question on to what extent and in what ways the situation in Afghanistan actually fuels the conflict between Pakistan and India.
Yes, I referred to that because, you know, there was this competition in Afghanistan by both India and Pakistan. And if you remember in the olden days, looking at the early 20th century, people used to refer to Belgium as the cockpit of Europe, because everyone used to go there and fight each other. So Afghanistan, unfortunately, has become the cockpit of Asia. And it will require an effort on the part of the near neighbors, which is India, Pakistan, Iran, China, and the Central Asian stands, to stop interfering inside Afghanistan. And the far neighbors, the Soviet Union, Russia, and its successor, Russia, and of course China again, and then the United States, from using Afghanistan as a place where they will resolve their differences at the expense of the Afghans. I think that will require some statesmanship, and there are not too many statesmen that I can see when I look at the map of the world today.
Here's one that's a little different in nature, but near and dear to my heart, as someone who worked on arms control and non-proliferation. Do we have confident knowledge of the Indian and Pakistani nuclear arsenals and their ability to assure the custody of nuclear materials? It plays a big role in that part of the world.
Yes, this is what gives sleepless nights to people in major capitals around the world. All the available evidence points to the fact that both India and Pakistan are very protective of the security and safety of their nuclear weapons. But having said that, there is no 100% security, and there's no 100% safety. I mean, the Japanese have had problems. The United States has lost nuclear weapons in transit between the West Coast and the East Coast. The commander of the Strategic Command acknowledged that to me because this had come out. They were supposed to be carrying dummy weapons across the country, and they actually had real weapons, and if that plane had a problem, they would have had to dump them somewhere in the middle of the country. So you can't have a 100% surety that the weapons will be safe. And what Pakistan has been doing is now moving towards what it calls as tactical weapons. Now, in my book, there are no tactical nuclear weapons. A nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon. It produces the same mushroom cloud, produces the same after effects, and it will provoke the same response from the other side, whether it's a small kiloton weapon or a large one. And so this is a very dangerous move. The other is both sides refuse to retire their old and dangerous weapons. They have these old missiles, but they like to show that they can kill each other many times over. And they refuse to do that. And to my mind, this was something that we worked with in the Track 2 dialogue between India and Pakistan. And Secretary George Shultz asked me to bring the dialogue to Stanford so he could teach them what he had learned of dealing with the Soviet Union on this matter, that they need to build confidence by saying, okay, we're going to retire these weapons, so we'll reduce the number of weapons both sides have. The one good piece of news is, it's not widely reported, every year on the 1st of January, both India and Pakistan actually share a list and a map of all their nuclear installations with each other. And the reason for this is that both of them have not a counter force but a counter value strategy. So they're not going to attack these sites if they go for each other. They're going to attack their cities. And this is, to my mind, a travesty, because India has something like all seven major Pakistani cities. Pakistan has targeted reportedly 10 major Indian cities. If 17 cities in the subcontinent literally go up in smoke and debris, the whole northern hemisphere will be under nuclear winter. And the world as we know it will end. So I don't understand that. But, you know, at least they're talking to each other. So there's some hope.
I think we have time for like one or two questions. I wanted to get this one in for sure. Yesterday in Islamabad, Islamists attacked a group of people celebrating International Women's Day, which brings to mind, can you comment on the role of women in battling to the heart of Pakistan? What is the role of women?
As a father of three daughters who are all doing interesting professional things, I'm a great supporter of women and women power. And I have a very high opinion of the women of Pakistan and India and Afghanistan and Iran. Because in that arc of instability, they provide hope for the future. If you go, as I travel throughout the region, and I know people in the region, some of the best work is now being done by the women, whether as scientists or as sportspersons or as politicians. Some of the most effective potential legislative pieces that have been put in the parliament in Pakistan have been by women members of the Senate and the National Assembly. And unfortunately, not all of them succeeded because the men are still in a patriarchal ruling mode. The Aurat March, as it's called, the Women's March, provoked a reaction from right-wing Islamists within the country because they saw it as an assault on their honor. And so they're trying to portray this as women who are losing their respect and that they should be items of respect, meaning that we should somehow cover them with a blanket and hide them inside the house. It's not going to happen. You now have women pilots, fighter pilots in the Pakistan Air Force. You have them in the military. I interviewed 15 of the top lady cadets at the Pakistan Military Academy, and I was thoroughly impressed by who they were and where they came from the cities, the middle class. So this is an attempt by obscurantist forces within the country to try and retain the old order, which is not going to be able to succeed. Having said that, let me just say, we're in America, and we're supposed to be the beacon for the rest of the world. And there is something called the Convention for the Elimination of the Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, which was trumpeted, among others, by Hillary Clinton in 1995 in Beijing at the Women's Summit. And to this day, the United States has not yet signed CEDAW. I think it's time that we signed it so that we can then turn around to the world and say that we believe in this and that we will support all countries that support women with equal rights. So let me end on that happy note.
Thank you. And Suja, we can't let you get away without giving you one of our much coveted Mid-Coast Forum mugs so that you can drink your tea or coffee in the morning, remembering us.
Thank you, George.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very nice. You covered a lot of area, a lot of